Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a typeface got involved in a political dispute and what changes could be on the way in the sports world in 2026. But first, Arizona's current budget allocates $5 million for research into the potential medical benefits of ibogaine, a psychedelic derived from an African root. Advocates like former U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema say it could have potential for treating conditions including PTSD. Sinema, in fact, testified in favor of the measure at the legislature that included the research money. My next guest spoke with Sinema at a conference hosted by the group Americans for Ibogaine. Erin Shoemaker is a deputy healthcare editor at Politico. She joins me to talk more about her piece, which is headlined, Kyrsten Sinema is Ready for Her MAHA Turn. Erin, when you spoke with Sinema, what did she say that surprised you?
I was surprised that Senator Sinema made the leap to MAHA. I know that she is a Democrat turned independent and is often cut against the grain, but that was a surprising thing for me to hear. I didn't think the conversation would go there. I expected to talk about Secretary Kennedy, and I've made some connections between psychedelics and MAHA and whether that might be part of the larger agenda there, but I didn't think that she would make that leap herself.
Does it seem as though psychedelics is sort of her main connection to MAHA? Because it seems as though, based on your conversation, it seems like there are other aspects of the movement that she is very much on board with.
She spoke positively about some of the other actions that MAHA has taken, about taking additives out of food or encouraging companies to do so. But it does seem like psychedelics are the strongest thread there. That's what she said she's talking to Secretary Kennedy about. That's where I think that she sees the biggest opportunity with the Trump administration to make inroads on this particular issue. She expressed positive feelings about some of the other food-related MAHA actions, but it does seem like psychedelics is the strongest thread.
And do we have a sense of what her goal is with psychedelics? Like, what is she trying to achieve?
She's working with Americans for Ibogaine, and that group is seeking ultimately FDA approval of Ibogaine as a mental health treatment at some point down the line. Now, to do that, they would need clinical trials to be approved by the FDA. This is sort of a long road, but their goal is to get states to work together and either fund or make agreements to do research on the drug Ibogaine and then eventually move it along through clinical trials to get FDA approval. That's their goal.
Okay. And it seems as though she was at least somewhat successful in Arizona getting some money in the last day budget for some research. Does it seem as though that's sort of the first step where advocates like Senator Sinema are focusing right now?
Yeah, I think that is one of the first steps. In Arizona, she was successful at lobbying Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs to include $5 million in Ibogaine research funding in the state's budget. And that was on the heels of something similar and even bigger happening in Texas, where $50 million was secured largely by former Governor Rick Perry of Texas and Brian Hubbard, who are both co-founders of Americans for Ibogaine. And that's the conference at which she was speaking when I interviewed her.
Right. Does it seem as though there are any parallels between what folks like Senator Sinema and others are trying to do with Ibogaine and what others have been doing with psilocybin research, it sounds like some of the benefits for military veterans and others might be sort of similar to between psilocybin, you know, magic mushrooms and Ibogaine.
I see some parallels there, and I see even more parallels to what happened with MDMA, also known as ecstasy. Last year, there was that drug got quite far along in the FDA pipeline, and it was up for approval. And ultimately, the FDA turned down the application that Lykos Therapeutics put forward last summer, and that sort of put a chill on the whole psychedelics industry for quite some time, probably until Donald Trump took office. Ibogaine is far, far behind where MDMA is. It's not as far along in clinical trials. But I do think that was sort of, yeah, that was the front runner sort of in this, race to bring a psychedelic medicine, across that FDA finish line.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that struck me as interesting based on your conversation with Sinema was the way that she described the Trump administration, the second Trump administration, in terms of being disruptors and this being a really good opportunity for folks who are looking to do things like get Ibogaine FDA approval or maybe even MDMA FDA approval. Can you talk a little bit about why she thinks now is the moment for this kind of thing?
Sure. So the way that Senator Sinema described it, she, called the Trump administration this sort of magical time in which there's a chance to get things done on psychedelic research. I think she sees it that way in part because the Trump administration is made up of so many disruptors. He's put disruptors into many different positions of power, but especially in the health department. You've got Secretary Kennedy, who's disrupting the food system and the vaccine system, and really making some big changes there. You've got Marty Makary at the FDA, and Jay Bhattacharya at NIH, like a whole Oz, Dr. Oz at CMS, a whole sort of cohort of disruptors. And she pointed out two secretaries that have been more or less outspoken about psychedelics, that being Secretary Kennedy and Doug Collins, the VA secretary, who has gone on podcasts to speak about psychedelics, talked with Trump at cabinet meetings, about the veteran suicide, epidemic. And yeah, those two together, I think she sees some promise there for making inroads on this issue.
So I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your conversation with Sinema about her trying Ibogaine. This came up. She apparently went to Mexico to try it at some point.
She did, yeah. This spring, she went to Mexico to a clinic there to try it, and they do. She's not the first person in Congress to do so. Representative Morgan Luttrell has been open about doing a similar treatment, Ibogaine treatment, in Mexico. And often, what people who go to these clinics will do is they will go there, and under the supervision of healthcare providers, will be administered Ibogaine, and they'll, be under supervision from these healthcare professionals, including some heart monitoring. There's some heart risks from taking Ibogaine. And then they'll be connected after their treatment with some kind of aftercare monitoring and almost like therapy from some of these healthcare providers.
Well, and it sounds like, based on what she told you, she's not necessarily looking to do it again, but it sounds like she had a fairly positive experience doing this.
Yeah, there are two interesting parts there, I thought. One is that, as far as I can tell, and based on my conversation with Senator Sinema, she didn't describe having any of these mental health conditions like depression or PTSD. She told me that her grandmother had experienced dementia, and that she was essentially trying to shore up her brain against dementia, whether or not that's something that this drug can do, who could say? But she said it made her feel sharper, clearer. She described her brain to me as feeling snappy. So she said the experience was worth it. I asked her if she would try it again. She said she sort of went back and forth and said she wouldn't like it, but she probably would try it again.
Yeah, that's so interesting. All right. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks so much for having me.
Aaron Shoemaker is a deputy healthcare editor at Politico. In times of political division, it can seem like just about everything, no matter how trivial, is fodder for debate. Recently, typefaces became a hot-button issue as Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced the State Department would be changing a Biden-era policy, stipulating that the Calibri typeface would be used on official documents. Rubio is pivoting back to Times New Roman, which the department had used for many years before the Biden administration switched to Calibri. Rubio said the return to Times New Roman had to do with President Trump's war against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. For some context on how these typefaces got caught up in all of this, my co-host Sam Dingman spoke with Karen Zimmerman, an illustration and design professor at the University of Arizona School of Art. As Zimmerman explained, it's all a question of readability.
Calibri is a sans serif typeface, so it doesn't have marks on the ends and the tops of the letter forms that we call serifs. So it's a more simplified type form. And so it's easier, especially on screens, to read. So the technical way that the font is designed, it's much more accessible for people with low vision or to be reading on a screen than a typeface that has a serif, which is Times New Roman. Also because of the spacing in between the letters, that also helps in the legibility or readability.
Am I right that there's more space between the letters in Calibri versus Times New Roman?
I think more and maybe more uniform. With Times New Roman, some letters are closer together, what's called kerned closer together.
Got it. And let's dig in a little bit more, if we can, on this question of serifs, because that seems to be where a lot of the conversation about this has really been focused. One way that I have been trying to think about this is if listeners think about the letter T in Calibri, you would just see the straight trunk of the tree and then a straight line across the top as the top of the tree. Whereas in Times New Roman, on the left and right sides of the top of the tree, there's these two little points hanging down. And at the base of the trunk, you kind of see the roots spreading out a little bit at the bottom.
Yeah, that's a really great sort of metaphor to think about the serifs. And they're kind of a leftover of the hand. So when people were using like a quill or a pen and they were writing, those serifs would have been part of that stroke.
What about Times New Roman specifically? What is the backstory of that font?
Times New Roman is what's called a traditional old style. So there's old style and then traditional old style. So all typefaces have sort of classifications, and Calibri would be classified as modern. And Times New Roman was invented around the 30s by Staniel Morris in England for the Times newspaper. And he worked with a type designer that worked on that. And they looked backwards in history for other typefaces, finding one that he thought would be more appropriate for the printing of the day, which was letterpress, I believe.
And so if a typeface like Calibri is classified, as you mentioned, as a modern typeface, is the lack of serifs, a sans serif font, a modern phenomenon in the literal sense?
I think there were sans serif typefaces that were used earlier as well. But I think what happened was there was the modernist movement where things were simplified and streamlined. Mm. And I think that is where the popularity of the sans serif typefaces came. A good example is Paul Rainier's Futura modernism. You know, when we think of modernist houses and, you know, new inventions of, you know, fast trains and going to the moon and, you know, those inventions that were happening in the 30s, 40s, 60s, you know, just sort of the change in our lifestyles, I guess.
And what about Times New Roman? I mean, I know you mentioned that originally it was thought to be in line with the letterpress technology.
Well, I think that Times New Roman is really probably what appeals to people to use Times New Roman is that it has a certain association with newspapers and truth, and it's more formal. It worked well with the printing because it was much darker. It had much more of a weight on the paper with the ink than the font that they had been using previously.
To go back to this question, you know, the reasoning that the administration gave for switching back to Times New Roman from Calibri was that it was part of their anti-DEI slate of initiatives. What is it about serifs that makes them harder to read for folks with visual impairments?
when they're looking at the font, there's less contrast between the white of the paper and the font because there's more information. So I think, especially at small sizes, it just can get more blurry. Whereas without the serifs, it's almost like I think you get less noise with the sans serif typeface.
In the simplest sense, I suppose, if a letter has serifs on it, there's more letter
Right,
and less
exactly.
background.
And so that space in between the two letters is not as geometric.
Interesting. Well, you teach at the University of Arizona in
Yes.
illustration design and animation. Tell me a little bit about how you talk to your students about typefaces and how they should make their selections.
So I want them to research who designed the font, what its history is, where it's from, because I feel like the more that they know about the font, the better, or the typeface, the better they can use it. So if they understand how and when it was invented and what for purpose, especially like the technology, like was it a letterpress, something that would be printed on letterpress, or is it a digital font? Are there things they have to consider about how it's going to be reproduced? Is it going to be printed? Is it going to be, a woodcut? Is it going to be something only seen on the web? Is it going to be seen at fast speeds, like, a typeface that you'd be using on a sign for a billboard? So knowing the ins and outs and the history of the typeface, I think, gives them a more informed reason to choose one font over another.
So, last question for you, Karen. If you were deciding what typeface to use to communicate on official federal matters, what would you choose if it was up to you?
Gosh, well, there are so many wonderful typefaces. It would be a really hard choice, but I think I would take an opportunity to have a custom typeface designed
Ooh, okay.
by someone, so that only that we would be the only, the government would be the only people that would have this particular typeface to use for their official documents. So
That's a
that's what
great
I would
idea.
do.
And would there be serifs?
I would make it in a typeface that had both a serif and a sans serif that worked well together.
Ooh,
So you
okay.
could, because often in documents, if you want to have changes in hierarchy or changes in the type of information, you might want to use a serif for certain parts, maybe the body copy, and then a sans serif for maybe the headers, or
Okay.
vice versa. And then you would have these two beautiful typefaces that would work well together.
In a time of politicization of typefaces, a unifying vision from my guest, Karen
Yeah.
Zimmerman, who is the interim director of the University of Arizona School of Art and is a professor there in illustration design and animation. Karen, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. It was fascinating. Fun to talk to you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a twist on the show's yearly eggnog taste test. But first, as we get closer to the new year, we're taking a look at what 2026 may hold in a few areas of life here in the Valley. Today, the sports landscape. The year started with the ASU football team's surprise run in the college football playoff and included the Phoenix Mercury's surprise trip to the WNBA Finals. But the Suns broke up their so-called Big Three after failing to make the playoffs, and the Cardinals are enduring another losing season. I spoke earlier about some of the big trends in sports on the horizon with Paula Bovin, a longtime sports reporter and columnist and director of the Cronkite News Phoenix Sports Bureau at ASU. And we started with some of the biggest issues she thinks we'll be dealing with and questions that'll need resolving in 2026.
I think one of the biggest storylines, and I'm excited it's a big storyline, is the WNBA and their CBA.
Collective bargaining agreement.
Collective bargain agreement, right. I think it's just a pivotal time. I mean, it's a pivotal time for women's sports, but what has happened, the transformation of the WNBA and the attention it's getting, there's a lot of leverage right now for the women, and there's some really big issues, and they are about to secure this huge television contract worth, I think, $2.2 billion and maybe more. So there's a lot of potential for the league to grow. And I think that's one of the biggest storylines.
As you say, potential for the league to grow, but also
it seems, potential for the league to really kind of have a problem, a self-inflicted wound, right? Like if it can't get a new labor deal in place, given, as you say, where it has gotten to over the last couple of years.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of attention on the commissioner of the league, who does not seem very well received by players right now. Mm-hmm. And it seems like any misstep or any storyline that has some negative perception gets blown up, whether it is, you know, traveling on in coach on Southwest Airline in a middle seat for a 6'7" center to, you know, it's inevitable people compare WNBA and NBA salaries. I don't think we're in a place to do that yet, but certainly the salary issue, the revenue distribution, the bad fan behavior, I think, has certainly had a spotlight on it in the last year. So there's a lot of storylines.
Speaking of labor disputes, Major League Baseball is potentially barreling toward another labor dispute with their collective bargaining agreement. How significant do you think the conversations around that will be, as opposed to maybe, hey, who's doing well in the field? Who's winning? Who's losing? Who's, you know, hitting a lot of home runs?
That's a great question. I think people, because it's a year out now, I think it's December 1st, 2026 is when they have to settle that. I don't think people really appreciate how bad it might get. Players remain adamant about not wanting a salary cap. I think the owners more than ever are pushing for it. You know, it's just not only the Dodgers and the Ohtani salary, but it's the salaries of a lot of the other players that don't have Ohtani skills. And so I've been talking to a lot of people, really respected writers I know in baseball, who said they've never sort of anticipated a, you know, a work stoppage like they expect this one's going to be. It could
really be
a short time. It could be a season. It's that bad. And I think if you ever listen to a player right now interviewed, they are absolutely, you know, adamant about not having that. So I think that's a storyline we're going to hear about in spring training, during the season and beyond.
Yeah. Well, and much like the WNBA, you know, ratings for Major League Baseball are up. Attendance is up. It had a terrific World Series, a very well-contested, exciting World Series. This would also seem like a pretty bad time for MLB to decide we're going to stop playing for a little while.
So bad, because you're right. All those good things are happening. And what was so funny, I thought, was the World Series kind of put a spotlight on these different sides, you know, having a Dodgers team that's so successful and then in the playoffs, and then a Brewers team that does not spend a lot of money, mm-hmm. but was successful until the end. I think that sort of put a spotlight on it. But there's been so much good happening in baseball. I thought even like the pitch clock, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah.
They're trying to move forward with the game, which is not something baseball has necessarily embraced in the past. So you'd hate to see that momentum stop.
You referenced the TV deal with the WNBA. Major League Baseball has a new media rights deal. When you look at sort of the money and the media rights involved for not just those two leagues, but leagues in general, what comes to mind for you and what do you think we should be looking for going forward?
What comes to mind is everyone I know, you know, reaching out, how do I find this game? I mean, and you know, obviously the older you get, I think the more challenging it is for some people. But I think even for the average fan, it's been frustrating. We are in a very bumpy transition time right now with broadcast and with streaming and finding things. And it's not just baseball. I think we're dealing with it all around. And I think trying to get some sense of normalcy for people and viewing and clarity is going to be something that they're going to have to solve soon, because there is some frustration on that end.
Yeah. Let me ask you about college sports, and especially in college football. We have seen an awful lot of change over a pretty short amount of time, be it in terms of the way that players move around, be it the way that they are paid now with NIL and the settlement money that they get, be it with the new championship, the playoff format that college football has. What are you looking for in terms of the effects of some of those changes on college football, or maybe even new changes coming up?
I struggle with this. You know, I look at the Sam Levitt situation, ASU's quarterback, who was beloved in this community. And then he misses the team banquet and word comes out that he's entering the portal. And just like that, people have turned. So the biggest challenge, certainly with NIL, is what's happening with loyalty, with fandom, things like that. I never thought I would go this direction, but I think at some point there has to be some parameters put around NIL. I absolutely believe in free enterprise and an athlete's right to earn money. But I think it's changing the sport in a negative way. How negative? I don't know, because once again, TV ratings have been great. And as much as people have been complaining about the CFP, certainly this season.
College football playoff.
The reality is we'll be talking about it all the way up into the championship game.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of still good things about the sport. But I think NIL and the transfer portal is making it a bit challenging. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see some kind of parameters. I just don't know what they are. And I honestly don't have a solution. It's going to take somebody really smart to figure this one out.
When you talk about potential problems with NIL and the transfer portal, is it really just about loyalty? Are there other concerns you have that you think might need to be addressed come 2026 or beyond?
You know, I mean, one of the things I've seen with NIL is there are some athletes who are suddenly making millions of dollars who have never been educated about how to manage their money, for example. I mean, it sounds so basic, and I think places and universities are doing a job with that. But I'm hoping that there is some responsibility and some guidance and leadership with those athletes. I think that's one of the problems. And I just saw a quote this week from, I think it was NAU's football coach, and they were tracking players even from their school who had transferred. And the reality was ones that had transferred, I think less than 50% were getting any more playing time at the places they landed. Mm. So it's not always a grass is greener type of situation. I think that's another thing they're dealing with.
It'd probably be interesting to also see if those players like have more endorsement deals, right? If they're making more money after they transfer. I would think that at least for some student athletes is a consideration.
Yeah, I think often that's right now, that's probably the number one courtship tool is what is the possibility of revenue generation? But we're also finding people are being promised money transferring to other schools, and then suddenly they're told that money isn't available.
Yeah. So we have spent this entire conversation not talking about actual teams in the Valley. There are some of those, right?
Right.
So I want to ask you, which of the four major professional teams in the Valley will go Suns, Cardinals, Diamondbacks, and Mercury? However it is that you define success, which of those teams will have the most success in 2026?
That is a great question. I think the Diamondbacks are getting closer. I don't think they're there. You know, I'll tell you, I don't know if they're going to have the most success, but they're that close. I think it are the Suns, who have been an absolute surprise this season.
Yeah.
You know, I think a commitment from the owner to fix things, a coach who is doing a better job of navigating difficult terrain, which is a lot of successful athletes with big egos. Then the way they've been playing, I don't know if it's going to happen for them in a year, but I think within the next couple of years, people are going to be talking about the Suns. And I'm optimistic about the Diamondbacks, too. I know this is a wishy-washy answer. I will not throw the Cardinals in there. I think they're a disaster right now, and I don't feel like there is something positive on the horizon, and that's too bad. And I ignored the Mercury because they've just been consistently good. But I mean, if we're looking at all those teams, probably immediate success, I think, is them because they're bringing a lot of really good players back.
All right, fair enough. We'll have to leave it there. That is Paula Bovin, director of the Cronkite News Sports Bureau here in Phoenix at ASU, longtime sports writer, sports columnist, many, many other things. Paula, good as always to see you. Thank you.
Great to see you, too. Thank you.
The United Nations Security Council this week is expected to meet to talk about Iran's nuclear program. This precedes an expected visit by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Florida to meet with President Trump next week. Those talks are also likely to include discussion of Iran. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, why is all of this so significant right now?
Yes, well, I think it's significant that the UN Security Council is meeting this week to discuss Iran. Now, Iran has been out of the headlines for a while, but if we just wind back about 6 months, we will remember that there was a 12-day war that went on between Israel and Iran in June, in the summer. And it was a pretty powerful conflict between the two. If you remember, they were kind of raining punches on each other. And the US, at the end of that, was called in to use B-2 bombers, stealth bombers, submarines, and so on to attack the nuclear facilities in Iran. So that's Natanz, that's Fordo, and that's one other. And the Fordo one in particular is a deep mine one, so it's a kind of underground one, and that was bombarded in order to try and really sort of shut out Iran's atomic program, and that includes its enrichment facilities and so on. And at the time, if you remember, the US and Israel said they'd done great damage to Iran's capability, and that was sort of accepted by, you know, some of the international media and so on. But now what will be very interesting is just to find out from the UN and the Security Council just how much that is actually true. And hopefully we're going to find some of that out this week. Now, it's quite difficult for the UN because Iran is not allowing UN inspectors in to check. And so it is conjecture to some degree. But we're hoping for some information on, you know, what really happened there, what was the consequence, and is Iran disabled, if you like, after those strikes. And, of course, Iran, we should just say, says it is not pursuing a campaign to build a bomb, and it did not have the kind of material, if you like, that the Americans and Israel have accused it of. So there are two sides to this coin. But it'll be interesting to see what the UN Security Council says later this week. We should find out a lot more.
All right. So, Rob, let's move now to the Ukraine-Russia war. And it feels like we've been talking about this pretty much every week over the last number of weeks. They will continue to be in the headlines this week. What's the latest there?
Yes. Yeah, so we talk about it so much because so much is happening. I mean, even today we have a senior Russian general has been killed by a car bomb in Moscow. So this guy was the head of operational training for Russia's military. And investigators are trying to work out whether Ukraine was involved. As a matter of policy, Ukraine never officially admits or claims responsibility for any such targeted attacks. But it's worth knowing that this general was the third Russian general to be killed in Moscow in the past 12 months alone. So it's clearly something is going on there that needs investigation. The other thing is Ukraine says Russian forces have intensified their attacks on the southern port city, the Black Sea city of Odessa, hitting facilities, cutting electricity supplies. This has been going on for some time. Ukraine's reconstruction minister says that these latest strikes have cut power to more than 120,000 people. And only a few days ago, we had 7 people killed in Odessa in similar sorts of strikes. If you set this against the background of Putin's annual State of the Nation speech that he gave on Friday, kind of press conference that goes on for about 4 hours, in which he said that there would be no wars beyond Ukraine if the West respects Russia. And he went into a bit more detail on that, saying no more eastern expansion of NATO and so on. So all of these things are happening together. We've even had those talks in Miami over the last day or two as well. So there's so much going on with Ukraine, and we expect to see a lot more this coming week.
Absolutely. So, Rob, two human rights organizations say Saudi Arabia has carried out a record number of executions this past year. What's the story here?
Well, this is interesting. Last year, Saudi Arabia carried out 345 executions. That was a record at the time, and they've gone beyond that, 347 for this year so far. We're nearly at the end of this year, of course. But this is interesting from a human rights point of view, because after all, Saudi Arabia is trying to diversify away from oil, and in some measure, it is opening itself up to the outside world and trying to change the perception that the world has of Saudi Arabia as being, you know, very authoritarian, very repressive, just relying completely upon oil and so on. So people now associate Saudi Arabia with major, major sporting events, big entertainment events. You hear of people now going as tourists to Saudi Arabia in a way that they didn't once do. So Saudi Arabia is trying to change its image and sort of culture. But at the same time, look what's really happening, say the human rights groups. There are these major executions or big numbers of executions going on across the country. And when you look at why people are being executed, well, it's hard to walk away from that feeling that this is anything other than a repressive regime, because a lot of these offences are what other countries would regard as kind of minor to moderate drugs-related offences. And many, many foreigners, by the way, getting caught up in this and executed in Saudi Arabia. So there's a difference between, to some extent, what Saudi Arabia says and what it does. And this story kind of shows that up.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, great as always to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. 3 years ago here at the show, we started a tradition, tasting executive producer Amy Silverman's eggnog. Here's Amy in 2022.
So I brought in one bottle that I made at Thanksgiving. So it's about 3 weeks old.
Yeah.
And then I brought another bottle that was in the back of the refrigerator that is vintage 2021. So it's been in the refrigerator for a year.
We were testing a Rockefeller University experiment that Amy had heard on Science Friday.
So we did a little bit of scientific research, and it turns out that the salmonella that may or may not be present in the eggnog you just tried should not be present in this eggnog because the alcohol kills it over time.
So a year old eggnog.
As it gets older, it gets safer and supposedly better.
Now, the scientists who conducted the original experiment didn't actually drink the eggnog they were inspecting, but that didn't stop us from sipping the same batches of eggnog year after year. This year, though, when we pulled the eggnogs of years past, they looked a little too much like science experiments for our taste, so we decided to switch things up a bit. The entire show team gathered to try two types of freshly made eggnog, and we tried to guess the twist in one of them. Our executive producer, Amy Silverman, do you call this a scientific experiment? I'm not even sure what you call this.
This is totally a scientific
Very scientific,
experiment.
Right?
Very scientific. My testing is more from a field perspective where I have people drink it, and then if they don't get sick, I decide there's less bacteria.
We're the people.
Well, it should be noted that we have done this now for I don't know how many years running we've done this. It's sort of a tradition here. And I can't speak for anybody but myself. I have not gotten sick. Lauren, have you gotten sick?
No, but I was pregnant last year and didn't partake. So we'll see.
And Sam, last year was your first year?
I felt a perceptible increase in happiness for the rest of the workday. I don't know what to attribute that to.
See? It's all good. All right. So should we get started?
Yeah.
Okay. This year we've got A and B. Mm-hmm. So you're first going to drink A.
Okay. All right. A, here we go.
Cheers.
Oh, I forgot to mention that the way that I make sure that it's safe is to put a lot of extra alcohol in.
Mm.
You'd never be able to tell by tasting
no.
it.
No. That was
it,
not
does
at all
taste like
my
pure
range.
Rum?
No. It tastes very good. Mm. I mean, it definitely tastes like what I would imagine eggnog Ooh. To taste like. My childhood was only drinking Hood out of the cardboard carton.
So what do you guys think?
I like it.
I really like it. For me, a lot of times eggnog can be sort of like unsettlingly gloopy, and this is not that at all.
Well, that was what was starting to happen with the old eggnog. I think it was safe, but the consistency was a problem.
It was getting thicker over the years.
It was less desirable, I think.
I think viscous was the word we might have used.
This goes down smooth. It's good, but it's strong.
Okay, ready for the – okay, now – We don't have, like, coffee grounds to sniff or anything, so just
clear our palates.
Yeah, clear your palates.
Here goes B.
Ooh, this smells stronger.
Yes. Ooh.
Just the smell.
I haven't tried either of these.
It smells like lighter fluid. Oh, but I like it.
Tastes stronger, too.
That's a different kind of alcohol.
This is whiskey or scotch, something smoky.
What do you think it is?
Mezcal?
I would agree with Lauren that it does taste a little smoky, but I don't know exactly what it is.
That's my guess, too, is mezcal.
Ooh.
It is mezcal.
I am
inspired
good.
By a trip to Oaxaca.
Mm. I mean, this is
so
nice.
I found a recipe with mezcal and creme de cacao.
Love.
I like this because it doesn't taste like eggnog or mezcal necessarily. It tastes like some third thing.
but with that smokiness.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is, I don't know if it still counts as eggnog, but I really like it.
It has eggs in it. It has all the others. It has heavy cream, eggs. It shouldn't be as sweet as the first one.
It's not.
Am I allowed to point out that Lauren is currently double fisting the eggnog?
I told she you is. I was pregnant last year, right?
Making up for lost time.
I get both.
Got to get a picture of that.
So, Amy, I've got to say, I like them both, but maybe I'm just a traditionalist. I like a little bit better. It feels more eggnoggy to me. Mm-hmm. The other one, the mezcal one, is also very good. There's something about the smokiness, though, that it's not off-putting. It's just it doesn't feel quite at home in that product to me. But they're both very, very good.
What's your vote, Sam?
Well, I'm realizing that I so associate the taste of that traditional eggnog. So in this case, that more traditional eggnog, the A, I think of that as such a distinctly holiday flavor. And when I taste it, I imagine holiday scenes in my mind. Mm-hmm. The mezcal one, I is a drink for all seasons.
Maybe a summer eggnog?
No, because to me, so I'm going to be the outlier here. I love be here with the mezcal because I think it's like drinking the fire that you're sitting next to.
Ooh, okay.
On a cold winter's night, mm-hmm, or a not so cold winter's night here in Phoenix. But I'm going for this one. Be all the way.
Well, so I guess the consensus is, as usual, Amy has outdone herself, mm-hmm, with the eggnog,
yes,
production.
Here's to that.
Really,
to
all that. I did was pour a lot of alcohol in.
And we appreciate it.
All right. So now the rest of the show staff is going to try the eggnog. Mm-hmm. So we're going to sign off and tell you all.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Happy holidays. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. And now to wrap up our year-end memories of Arizonans who passed away in 2025. Angel Diaz was an all-around artist, from graffiti to tattoos to public murals and even jujitsu. Moving through downtown Phoenix, you've probably seen one of Diaz's many public murals around town. He's the artist behind Super Barrio Bros that lived on the corner of 16th Street and Van Buren until earlier this year. He also worked with fellow artists Pablo Luna and Lalo Cota on the Bienvenidos a Phoenix postcard-style mural as part of the Calle 16 project in 2011. But Cota had known Diaz for many years prior.
I met him in the 90s, and he was a break dancer in those days, so he was really slim. And he did graffiti, and I remember he was wearing a hat, and it had his name on it, which was Mess. His graffiti name was. It was a camouflage hat, and he wrote on it "Mess" in black and white, bold letters. We used to poke fun at him because he was a little bit messy. He was like the Tasmanian devil. Whenever he came and we were hanging out, he would just come in like a little tornado and just, you know, move everything around. We used to call him Messy Mess. When he would work on something, he would really get into it. He did tattoos. He painted with airbrush. He painted with spray paint. He tried oil painting. He painted with acrylics, watercolor. I mean, you name it, he would try it. He was dabbing in sculpture. When he picked up something new, he like worked on it until he mastered it. And I just always admired that about him. With his artwork, he included like his Mexican culture and like Aztec culture. So he put that in with American culture. He mixed all that in together. I actually recently found one of his paintings, and it was unfinished, and it was of a Chola woman from the barrio, you know, and I was like, oh, that's Angel's, you know, and I brought it home with me. His work was not signed or anything. It just his style was his signature. He just had a really good sense of humor, so when you could feel that in his artwork. So he was always cracking jokes. It was always a good time. He had a magnetic laugh. I can hear him. Another friend of ours, Pablo Luna, who passed away a couple of years ago, when they would get together, it was like a comedy show. I could hear both of them laughing as we share these stories. When you talk about someone, I know a lot of people say the generic stuff, who he was great, he loved life, all that stuff. But he was really a genuine person. If he said you were his friend, I mean, you were his friend, and you could count on him. Even if you hadn't talked to him in a while, he was a person that would show up. He was definitely... he was definitely a real friend. If he said he was your friend, he was your friend.
That was Lalo Cota remembering his friend, Phoenix artist Angel Diaz. You can find more remembrances of Arizonans who passed away in 2025 at KJZZ.org. Phoenix poet Rosemary Dombrowski is embracing old holiday traditions this year. She'll tell us why in this latest essay in our Eating Christmas collection.
When I was 20, I proudly announced at Thanksgiving dinner that I would no longer be acknowledging a holiday that celebrated colonialism, and I was now a vegetarian. I turned my nose up at the ham, and I've always hated pumpkin pie. So my mother concocted a recipe for pumpkin spice cake with dark chocolate chips and buttercream frosting. She refused to let go of traditions, but she made every effort to amend them to my approval. Still, I spent holidays complaining about the meat that was contaminating my food, or the number of holiday installations that were making my mother's tiny townhouse feel oppressive. To be fair, her decorations were classic and beautiful, with just a smattering of those cheesy, interactive ones that I always rolled my eyes at. After dinner, she would grab one of the latter and somehow get us to play like kids again. Her favorite was a voice-activated Santa preloaded with 8 Christmas tunes. She told us all we had to do was request a song and Santa would sing it for us. "Santa, play Deck the Halls." "Santa can't quite hear you. Please try again." "Santa, play Joy to the World." "Santa doesn't understand your request. Please try again." This would go on for minutes, tears streaming down our faces. As my mother aged, I begged her to move the celebration to my house, which was more than twice the size of hers and just as meticulously decorated. But she refused. Holiday entertaining was her pride and joy, and there was no way she was going to relinquish it. At least not until 2022. On Christmas afternoon, I picked her up, drove her back to my house, and reheated the veggie pizza I'd ordered the day before. That's the kind of cook I am. While my mom was eating day-old pizza, I complained about my relationship and my upset stomach and all the work that still needed to be done. I complained about everything. It was a typical holiday in that sense. Yet all she kept saying was, "This is the best Christmas ever." And since it clearly wasn't, I couldn't shake this uneasy feeling. After dinner, she calmly told me that she had stopped taking all of her medications. I doubled over, struggled to catch my breath. "You can't just stop taking blood pressure meds, Mom. How many weeks has it been? My God, how many months?" In her characteristically soft-spoken tone, she said, "Maybe a couple." Like all the times she'd fallen and not told me, this was yet another secret she'd managed to keep. When I asked her why, she said, "You're too stressed, too busy, and I didn't want to put anything else on your plate for fear that you'd complain." A few months later, my mother was in hospice. I played Frankie and Bing, Pavarotti and Bublé, her holiday staples. Last year, I almost put batteries in the singing Santa. No matter how silly, I'm not interested in new traditions because the ones my mom created, despite all my complaining, were perfect.
That was Rosemary Dombrowski performing live on stage at Crescent Ballroom. You can find more Eating Christmas essays at kjzz.org. And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thanks, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @kjzztheshow.